Thomas, how are you?
Good evening. You see, I'm still figuring what's the next serenade that I need to bring in to 2015 for you.
Well, as they say, Thomas, go figure. Okay. I'm figuring something else. Clown and Philosopher, the title for tonight's programme. Clown and Philosopher, it doesn't really ring it for me. But looking through the programme, it's all about death. It's all about darkness. Even the sound of some of the... I mean, the viola has a darker, deeper, more mellow sound than the violin, for instance. So I'm thinking to myself, well, darkness on the edge of town. It's the obvious thing, you know. Of course, if they named it that, you might have thousands of people outside expecting a Springsteen concert, you know. So perhaps that wouldn't do. But I remember when Darkness on the Edge of Town came out. I was working in Dallas, Texas. It had been released that spring. I was on a J-1 visa, you know, and I was working on a building site. It was like the temperature was over 100 degrees Fahrenheit every day. The humidity was 100%, and there's me working away on the building site. It was like a cross between a sauna and a furnace, you know. But that album marked that summer for me. And especially I love the way it builds all the way through the album to the final, the title track at the end. It's just superb. But that wouldn't do for tonight. I have another suggested title for tonight, Tomás. Strauss the Straddler. How about that?
Well, I'm afraid I'm just overwhelmed with a sort of a vision of you sort of in your Springsteen jeans, maybe a little ripped T-shirt with a hard hat and one of those lovely 1950s airline lunch boxes straddling the top of a sort of an iron girder 70 stories up in an American building site. It's a sight that will never leave me.
There you go now, you see. But being more musical about it, Tomás, the reason I'm saying Strauss the Straddler is because he straddles tonight's programme.
Yes.
Obviously, he bookends tonight's programme with the two-tone poems. But he straddled so much. I mean, he came from, you know, mid-19th century, essentially, to mid-20th century. Of course, that's his problem, I think, is that he defies easy categorisation. People don't know where to place him in the pantheon. Was he a 19th century composer? Yes. Was he a 20th century composer? Yes. Was he an opera composer? Yes. So because of that, I think he tends, in critical terms, he falls between stools. And then, as I say, people don't really know how to place him. Till Eulenspiegel here tonight. Where do you stand on that, Thomas?
Well, I stand very close to it so that I can say it very gently. Till Eulenspiegel.
Oh!
Thank you. But what I totally agree. I mean, I think what you're looking at with Strauss and why it's, you know, such an interesting year to have had Richard Strauss.
Richard?
I think we're going for Richard's. 2015, we've decided to embrace Richard Strauss.
This is revisionism of the worst kind. You're saving your German for the final piece on tonight's programme, Thomas, which is...
Tod und Verklärung.
Oh, that's impressive.
Death and Transformation. Now, you look at that, and that's 1888. It is deep within the heart of the 19th century. It's not, you know, a borderline piece. This is really shockingly modernistic in the sense that we think, you know, we've now, or rather the 20th century has appropriated this kind of tonal sketching for itself. But here it is. This is right in the middle of the, the two-thirds way through, shall we say. Here it is, right at the heart of the 19th century. And I think so. I'm worried that we are falling into the trap that of thinking of centuries as defining the musical sort of image or the cultural image of a thing, rather than thinking about people. And that's the problem with Strauss the Straddler. That's all I would say. Strauss the Straddler insists that we're within a very heavily structured sort of timeline. And that we're getting over the hurdle of 1900 into the 20th century. In fact, what we're looking at is staggering works of genius by somebody who is a genius. And that we should be thinking about the centuries and the rest of time moving around him rather than he moving around time. And I think this is where it shows. He's 25 years of age when he writes Death and Transfiguration. It's a startling thing to do. At 25, mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful piece. It's a really wonderful piece. Although,
is it really wonderful?
I do like it, and I'll tell you, I find that it is a bit irritating that he came back and he had such good public relations presence of mind that on his deathbed he confirms to the onlookers, just in case anyone's taking notes, yes, by the way, the experiencing what I'm experiencing now is exactly what I wrote with death and transformation. It was smart.
But taking you back there to Mossy, you're mentioning about the tone poems being, you know, the work of genius. Think of our first piece here this evening, which we've already heard, the Till Eulenspiegel. It doesn't engage me. It impresses me. I think Strauss was in a rebound mold at the time. I think his opera Guntram had been critically panned. I think he was regathering the forces, you might say, and saying, look what I can do. I can write this brilliant orchestration, and it is very good. It's a piece almost for like virtuoso orchestra to let them show off, and some lovely solo pieces in it as well. But I find it a bit episodic. Now, obviously, it is episodic. It's telling a story. I'm wondering, is it trying to carry too much there in terms of the story? This rogue, Till Eulenspiegel, I see him as a sort of a Dick Turpin character. That's my first interpretation. Because, you know, he's a bit of a chancer. He's cocking a snoop at society. He's going around rampaging. He's upsetting things and eventually gets executed because of this. So you think to yourself, geez, he must have done something a bit serious. But of course, you know, Dick Turpin was executed for stealing three horses. So that's the sort of thing that could happen to you then. At the same time, though, Tomás, I mean, these fellas were hoodlums. You know, Turpin was certainly a hoodlum. Why is it that we have this manic idea of turning villains into some sort of heroes, you know, whether they're pirates or buccaneers or gangsters, you know, Al Capone or Dillinger, who now has a restaurant named after him. All this sort of thing. We've got this morbid fascination with it. But that would be my first sort of thing. Maybe that's what he was, the Dick Turpin sort of character. So that would be a sort of a first look at it. But I can see you're anxious to get in.
Oh,
with a counterpoint.
I am.
My
well,
lord.
I mean, well, I think we, you know, we enjoy the villain figure, because what they're doing is that they are undermining the you know, the structures of power in the state, and particularly characters like Robin Hood and Till Eulenspiegel, which is what Eulenspiegel is. He's a Germanic, Flemish, Dutch, Northern French Robin Hood.
Not a Dick Turpin.
Oh, okay. And what he's undermining, but in a very flirtatious and sort of Errol Flynn type way. the young people. Yes, I got Errol Flynn in again.
Buckles will be swashed.
They are going to be swashed again. And he's constantly attacking. Now again, he's a character. He's a proper literary character. And in the Germanic language, he crops up all over Middle Europe. Strauss, you know, has gone for the 19th century Grimm's fairy tale version of it, and he's also got the you know, that Till Eulenspiegel is dying at the end, which of course is very interesting, because what it does is it seals away and says, if you do try to undermine the church, the state, and these things, you'll find yourself hanging at the end of a rope. And that's a very interesting take on this kind of otherwise anarchic figure, which, you know, occur throughout history, I think.
So, Tomás, are there any early, say, 21st century figures who fit that bill?
Well, you'd be hard-pressed to get somebody without libelling them.
But Russell Brand?
Yeah, I think maybe Russell Brand is not bad. I mean, he's a japester. He has a way with the ladies. He's a good communicator, and he tends
he's
to try
and...
He's
a stone in my shoe.
Well, I... Well, he's definitely a merry prankster. Now, he can be irritating and all those other things, but I suppose that's exactly what you're looking at here. And he very much, I think you've hit a home run there, because he fits all of the elements within the Till Eulenspiegel tone poem. You've got the once upon a time start, you've got the playful sort of japester middle bit, you've got the querulous romantic chasing the fairer sex.
Ladies.
Well, yes, whichever which you wish to say. Then, of course, we've got the next thing coming, unfortunately for the Russell Brand character, would be the dark ascent to the scaffold. I think maybe we could draw a line before that.
You did mention earlier that not all of them end that way, that some of the earlier, the middle-aged ones don't end in that sense.
Correct.
And I'm wondering, could we elevate Till Eulenspiegel here this evening into more of a Socratic figure? figure, a man who purposely turned himself into the stone in society's shoe, who held the mirror up to society, who asked the awkward questions until such time, just like Socrates, until such time as society decided to get rid of him because he was annoying them and he was exposing their faults and foibles and all the rest of it. So you could perhaps look at it that way as well, and not just as some sort of a roguish highwayman.
Right. Well, I mean, so the only problem is there that we need to give Till Eugenspiegel and Russell Brand the opportunity of either A, leaving the country and stopping talking to us, or B, taking a large glass of hemlock. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm going to have a sip of this drink here.
You sure it's not hemlock now? But I would say this, that on the music, I'm not overly impressed. I think it's one of these pieces that impressed them tremendously in 1894.
Yeah.
But now, with over a century of film music for slightly cartoonish, childlike activities, this feels like, and I, you know, I feel I'm about to be run through by supporters of by Strauss. If when I say this
yes,
next
I can
one,
see a few heads turning over there. Tomas.
It doesn't.
Keep your voice down.
Didn't it feel just a little like the kind of soundtrack you'd have to a Tom and Jerry extended cartoon? You know, plink, plink, plink. Oh, there's the bit where he's ascending the scaffold, moody middle section. It, and unfortunately, the tone poem idea brilliantly comes out in film music in the 20th century, and that's unfortunately his legacy from these tone poems has turned out to be film music rather than a new form of symphonic expression.
I think you hit the nail on the head there when you said, you know, you weren't impressed by it, but it makes an impression, I would add. You know, it certainly, you know, you can't fail to get that appreciation of it. But the word I used earlier was that it just doesn't engage me. You know, I sort of, there seems to be a glass wall between me and it. Yes, very impressive and a fantastic vehicle for the orchestra to show off. There's no question about that. But moving ahead, Tomas, the Bartok. Now, there's something I think you could get a bit of meat and drink out of the Bartok here, and I'll tell you why.
Good.
I'll tell you why, Mr. Clancy. An unfinished piece. Oh, was it lead for... I mean, there's been a book written about it, about this particular piece itself, because there's charges of inauthenticity in the way it was finished and so on and so forth. And then, of course... Bartok's son sort of took back possession of the piece 40 years after it was originally written in 1995. He sort of took back the possession of the piece and put it, as I said, he stamped it with the family escutcheon and sort of said, now this is our piece. This is Bartok Pere Fils and none other. You see, but I'm thinking all these charges of inauthenticity to most, I'm sure you could find a smoking gun there or a hidden agenda or something there to give us a bit of meat and drink on that.
Well, I've you know, no. I think you know, what you're looking at is that obviously he was commissioned to write the piece, and it was Primrose, I think, wasn't it?
William Primrose.
William Primrose, and he was commissioned by him to go ahead and write it, and he was writing it for a very long time. The thing I was worried about was the familiar letter from the editor saying, "How's that going?" And Bartok sending back the letter saying, you know, all practically done, just a couple of things to polish off now. I'll be pressing send any minute.
We've
now.
Never done that.
No. And of course, he then drops dead, and then they go, oh, well, he has this one nearly finished. Oh, not quite as finished as he said.
Was it Stephen Sondheim? I think, I can't remember. He said, if you want the song on Tuesday morning, it means I get going on Monday night.
Very wise, very wise man.
Ladies and gentlemen, our doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Our doors will close in 5 minutes.
Problem is that it's perfectly well agreed. This isn't one of these pieces that, such as the we were talking about Prokofiev and some elements within Shostakovich, where we'd had found pieces and assembled pieces. Bartok wrote the drafted the large outline sketches for this viola concerto on his deathbed or in the room, as we said. And so we've got all the material pretty much close together. We've got very heavy description of what was intended. and we have a great deal of the material found subsequently to his death and assembled. So what don't we have? We didn't have some of the stitching structures between the various pieces that he had, and they have, you know, it starts here and drops to here. I think you're entitled to fill in that. This is much more like restoration within a painting, where you've got the bulk of the painting is there and you're just filling in a little a beige that smooths to, through to grey, rather than the wholesale invention of something where you're saying this material here, as in Prokofiev, it looks like it's going to be something we're going to weld together into a new found piece, or, God between us all harm, yet another unfound set of material from Bob Dylan.
Well, yeah, well, this is it, Tomasa. I'm not sure that you have... I think you've refused my gift of a conspiracy theory there and the gun and the rest of it. But as I say about this piece, there's a double gift here. Because I think, with our soloist here tonight, Maxim Risen, a very highly regarded guy, he released, just as an aside to us, he released a disc there earlier this year of Bach cello suites. Now, these were transcribed for viola, and it's been very highly regarded, just saying that in terms of what he can get out of the instrument, it's as if he transcends the instrument's limitations and takes it to a new level and makes it as expressive almost as the violin, which is obviously the better known and more popular instrument, and so forth. But I call this a double gift because, first of all, well, you know, there was the conspiracy theory I hoped you'd come up with there, but you turned me up. And the second,
it's a new leaf for 2015. That's what I'm turning up. A new leaf.
No more smoking guns. But I enjoyed those.
Oh, they're coming back.
But I think for the soloist, whoever it may be, it's Maxim Rizanov here tonight, but whoever the soloist may be in this part, I think it's a challenging gift in the sense that what are you going to do with this? Because things like bowings and fingerings, there's controversy as to what it should be. So I think somebody who can step up to the mark and not be intimidated by that challenge, I think it allows them to give a virtuoso performance of the piece. And that's what performing art is all about. There has to be an interpretive level of it.
The Allegro Vivace, I mean, is to me, that's the soul of the piece. It's absolutely the soul of the piece. And the surprising bit, and the only bit that I would start to get my conspiracy theory hat on, is when we come to the closing, which to me, that's where, you know, Bartok's Viola Concerto suddenly goes all Gershwin. He's now been embraced by New York. He's been living there, and then suddenly we don't get enough of New York, and here's an opportunity in a posthumous piece to put in a bit of glamoury, glitzy 40s, 50s New York stitched into it. That's where I'd see the conspiracy. I think the other conspiracy is possibly...
You're on a roll now.
I'm back on it now again.
Your New Year's resolution is broken already.
Well, I'm back on the sweets as well, let me tell you. At this stage, fully back on the sweets. It became a very obsessive idea to get the purity of exactly what was written down in the scripts, and you know, he finally got round to looking at tiny discrepancies in opening notation, closing notation, the swish of a pen, every mark. It's very much like the insanity related to the versions of Ulysses. And endlessly correcting tiny faults. For me, with the one objective of extending copyright,
we've got the hidden agenda.
That's it.
And
the opportunity of dragging the money back there. And you know, if you're suddenly going back, and as he does say several times, we have to go back to the original script and start again. You're thinking, yes, let me reset that copyright clock.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.